Please be seated.
Recording in progress.
All right, our next case on the docket is 5-24-0656, People v. Tinsley. Appellant, if you are ready, please identify yourself for the record and you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Elizabeth Crotty and I represent Amari Tinsley in this matter. Counsel. Amari's appeal presents his court with one question. Did his pro se post-conviction petition meet the very low threshold of the first standard, the first stage of proceedings, and merit second stage post-conviction proceedings? Because his petition did state the gist of a meritorious claim, he asked that this court reverse and remand for the appointment of counsel and assistance at the second stage of proceedings. Dismissal of a post-conviction petition at the first stage is only appropriate if the petitioner does not state at least one claim that is not frivolous or patently without merit, meaning that it is not based on an indisputable legal theory or fanciful factual allegations. Here, Amari stated two such claims that meet that standard. He alleged ineffective assistance of counsel, that his counsel did not seek an expert to support the theory of defense at sentencing, and that counsel did not investigate available witnesses and evidence that would have supported defense claims that were or could have been made at sentencing that regarding Jerome's character and propensity for violence, more detailed and supportive evidence for the sequence of events on the date in question, and details about an incident 2 days prior to the charged conduct that informed Amari's decision to arm himself at school. Now, both of these claims have an arguable basis in fact and in law, and that is the first stage, that is the standard at the first stage of proceedings, that counsel's conduct was arguably unreasonable and arguably prejudicial to Amari's sentencing. Now, to be clear, Amari is not asking to vacate his guilty plea or conviction. He's not asking for this court to reduce or vacate his sentence. He's not asking for this court to order the appointment of an expert or to order discovery on remand. He's simply asking that this court find that he met the gist standard and that he should be remanded for the appointment of counsel to assist in developing these claims at the second stage of proceedings. Now, these claims are also not forfeited or waived, and that's been a strong argument of both the court below and of the state on appeal. These are not the same claims that were raised in direct appeal, nor could they have been, because they are based on, at least in part, on facts and factors that are outside of the record, such as what counsel did not do, conversations between Amari and his counsel. Those are not matters of the record. Amari did a FOIA request, and there are witness comments on the incident and the previous incident in that return. And there are details about Jerome's history and reputation in the community. In the petition itself, that add to detail what was and was not available at sentencing. So, because counsel's inactions in this case are at least arguably unreasonable and at least arguably prejudice Amari at sentencing, they meet that very low first stage standard. And unless this court has questions, I'll reserve any remaining issues for rebuttal and ask that this court, because Amari's petition states at least one claim, and this court can grant relief on either or both claims, that is not based on an indisputable legal theory or frivolous factual allegations, that this court reverse and remand for second stage proceedings so that Amari can develop his claims with the assistance of counsel.
Justice Scalia,
any questions? Thank you. No questions.
No, but I was going to point out, I believe this case, again, they run together, but there was a motion filed to cite additional authority, the Spencer case, and I think that was originally denied because the mandate was not final. The mandate has since been issued, and a motion to reconsider was filed, and I believe we voted to take the motion with the case. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes. That was by the state, and yes. So I have no objection, Your Honor. I will just say briefly that while it's certainly relevant authority, it's absolutely not dispositive, and it emphasizes some of the confusion that the state has in its brief that this is somehow a Miller claim or a Miller adjacent claim, and it is not. This is not a case where we're talking about life without parole or an unconstitutional sentence. We're talking about what counsel could and should have done at the sentencing hearing to better support his arguments in mitigation. So the issue is whether those actions could have impacted the sentence at all, not whether we're looking at a unconstitutional sentence. So thank you for that clarification.
Thank you, Justice Bond, for that. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Appellee, you may proceed. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. John Barrett, arguing on behalf of the people of the state of Illinois. Can you hear me? Am I coming through okay?
Yes, we can hear you just fine.
Okay, good. I am getting started here. Today I will demonstrate three essential points. First, defendant's claims are forfeited under Blair because the essential information he relies on was fully present in the original trial record and available on direct appeal. Second, his claim regarding expert testimony on youth fails on the merits. The bright line rule for youth protections remains fixed at age 18, and the record shows the trial court already thoroughly considered and weighed defendant's youth against the aggravating circumstances. Third, his claim regarding counsel's investigation fails under Strickland. No competent attorney would pursue evidence that is neither legally irrelevant or objectively harmful to defendant at sentencing. But before turning to forfeiture, it's important to note that defendant's petition is asking this court to ignore the factual and legal framework established in this case. Defendant's argument hinges on People v. Gray to suggest his guilty plea was not a wholesale acceptance of the factual basis of his plea. This reliance mischaracterizes Gray, which involved using a third-party witness's plea as evidence in a contested jury trial. Gray prevents bootstrapping collateral facts through a witness's plea to prove a defendant's guilt. It doesn't give defendants the right to admit to a detailed factual basis in pleading guilty and later dismiss those admissions as irrelevant collateral matters. Unlike Gray, which involved disputed facts during the jury trial, this case involves defendant's voluntary plea of guilty, which he has never sought to withdraw. The facts he admitted that he shot an unarmed man who was attempting to retreat are not collateral matters. They are the core of his conviction. Additionally, those facts are now the law of the case. On direct appeal, this court made conclusive findings that Jerome was not the aggressor after the parties separated. He was not armed, and his retreat negated any inference of mutual combat. These are not contested facts. They are settled law following direct appeal. Most importantly, this case centers on allegations of sentencing ineffectiveness, not trial ineffectiveness. Which principles about the victim's character don't apply when the essential facts are established? This renders defendant's entire theory of provocation, which relies on Lynch, legally meritless at this stage. Lynch principles are a tool for trial. They aid the jury in deciding who the aggressor was in a disputed confrontation. That question is irrelevant in sentencing. Defendant also fails to provide any analysis of why a Lynch motion would have been successful at sentencing. Here, the court knew from defendant's guilty plea that the confrontation had ended and the victim was retreating. Counsel cannot be effective for pursuing actual mitigation evidence rather than legally meritless attacks on the victim's character at sentencing after guilt has already been established. Now, turning to forfeiture, this threshold issue of forfeiture is dispositive. I don't want to belabor the point that the brief, the people's brief goes into sufficient detail to support it, but I just want to mention that under People v. Blair, issues that could have been raised on direct appeal but were not or forfeited, defendants' claims here fall squarely under this category. Now, Jerome Merriweather, the victim in this case, his criminal history was in the record, but was not hidden. It was fully documented in his sworn evidence deposition. He testified to his two prior felony convictions for aggravated battery. The FOIA request does not present new evidence. This is just expanding out on this notion that the victim was somehow responsible for what happened. But as this court found on direct appeal, this is not a case where there was mutual harm or violence on the part of the victim. So there's no dispute about that. And defendant isn't attempting to withdraw their plea here. So this idea in Blair that issues could have been raised but were not are forfeited, I think applies in this case. But even if we look at the merits, even if we turn to the merits here, this argument asks the court to ignore established precedent. As the Fourth District in People v. Masters decided, that the constitutional protections for youthful offenders do not extend beyond the bright line rule of 18. Here, defendant, even here at oral argument today in brief, acknowledges that they're not raising the Miller claim. And context matters because here we don't have proportionate penalties claim being brought. As in, having in Masters, this is why in Masters we got to a third stage proceeding. We have a proportionate penalties claim being brought. Here, there's no Miller type claim. There's no proportionate penalties claim. We have a claim of ineffective assistance based on flawed reading of the facts and the law in this case. Looking at the investigation claims, under Strickland's objective reasonableness standard, there's no competent attorney who would have presented the evidence he now suggests at sentencing. As the people addressed, any attempt to introduce Lynch evidence about the victim's character was legally irrelevant in sentencing. His argument is weakened by the petition's own evidentiary flaws. On page 21 of the opening brief, the defendant improperly cites arguments from the victim's attorney's brief in a separate federal case as if it established facts about the victim's purported violent tendencies. This reliance on an improper source rather than actual evidence underscores the speculative nature of the claims. Here we don't have witness affidavits. We have no witness affidavits from either an expert or other witnesses that support any of these claims. That alone shows the insufficiency of the petition and that the trial court's dismissal of the petition at the first stage was warranted. Second, the evidence in the January 25th incident at the Cadillac Lounge was objectively harmful, not mitigating. Competent counsel would never introduce facts showing their client was present at a bar while underage with dangerous associates during an incident of gun violence just 2 days before he'd be brought on to school. This evidence does not suggest mitigation. It shows premeditation, directly contradicting the heat of the moment narrative the defense sought to establish and giving the trial court even more reason to impose a higher sentence. In his reply brief, the defendant argues that the people are improperly speculating about trial counsel's strategy, which he asserts is not appropriate at the first stage. This mischaracterizes our argument. The people are not speculating about what was in counsel's mind. You're applying the objective reasonableness standard from Strickland. The analysis is not subjective, but legal and objective. Under the law of this case, where the victim is retreating, character evidence about him is legally irrelevant. Evidence of a prior gun-related incident is objectively harmful because it supported premeditation. We are not asking this court to read counsel's mind, but to recognize that no competent attorney would introduce evidence that is legally irrelevant or strategically self-destructive. For these reasons, the circuit court properly dismissed defendant's post-conviction petition at the first stage. And now I will turn it over for any questions that you may have. I know we're short on time.
Any questions?
No questions.
No questions. All right. Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal?
I'd like to focus this court's attention on the issues of what is and isn't relevant or admissible at sentencing. Counsel wants to argue, you know, Lynch is about trial strategy. Agreed. You know, the issues of provocation and self-defense or imperfect self-defense are enshrined in our statutes as appropriate consideration for mitigation. What we're talking about here in this post-conviction petition is context. Amari has never done anything but plead guilty and stick with his plea. He's not asking for anything else. He agrees that what he did was wrong. He agrees that it was both legally and morally wrong. What he's asking isn't for an attorney who can give the court context about his decisions shortly after his 18th birthday and how his youth and personal characteristics and other events in his life between these parties and the reputation of the adult man involved in this situation, how that impacted his decision-making on that day. And that is absolutely relevant to sentencing and an appropriate consideration for trial counsel and for the court.
But at the sentencing hearing, didn't the trial judge go through his youth, his background, all these things, and discuss those in the ruling?
To some degree, he did. And we're not arguing that the, you know, this is an issue of what should have been before the trial court, not what was. And we've learned from case law and from experience that an expert's understanding of what youth is and a layperson or an attorney or the court's understanding of how a particular person such as Amore at just 18 with how those factors in his life impacted him specifically. So it is an individual case. And, you know, the state goes on that, you know, 18 is the line, right? 18 is the line. But even Roper in 2005 says, you know, for purposes of our decision, 18 is the line between adult and juvenile, but it doesn't mean that those characteristics stop at age 18. And when we get past age 18, that's where we really need to see that expert opinion and evidence so that we can understand how this applies to someone who is, legally speaking, an adult. And again, we're not asking for the court, and it's not appropriate to make factual or credibility determinations at this stage. What we're asking is the ability to develop this. And it may be that it goes back and counsel is unable to make a meritorious claim going forward, but we can't know that without appropriate second stage proceedings. And one other point, the post-conviction law allows for discovery, it allows for counsel, and it allows for the appointment of an expert. So if the lack of that, and that means that the lack of those, the lack of expert witness evidence at this stage is not dispositive, and it's certainly too much to ask of a person convicted shortly after 18 and proceeding pro se at the first stage of post-conviction petition. So unless this court has other questions, we simply ask that this court reverse and remand for second stage proceedings where counsel can assist in the development of these claims.
Yes, no other questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We will take this matter under advisement and issue a ruling in due course. Thank you.
Recording.